Are you an adventurer looking to take your hunt to the next level? Then you're in the right place. Welcome to East Meets West Hunt with your host, Bo Martonic.
Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of the East Meets West Hunt podcast presented by Spartan Forge. On today's episode, I am joined by champion turkey caller and hunter Bo Brooks. Bo is known for being able to fool just about anything with a mouth call, elk, ducks, turkeys, and whatever else. So we discuss him growing up in the West, finding the turkey that wants to play your game, midday turkeys, what to do when a tom has hens with him, a ton of different calling strategies, our top gear for turkey hunting, how to deal with ticks, and much more. 100% born in the Appalachian Mountains and made in the USA, Timber Ninja Outdoors provides a range of mobile hunting options to accommodate diverse hunting preferences. Whether you prioritize comfort, lightweight design, or versatility, their two-panel and single-panel saddles collection has something for everyone. The Black Belt Nano is the lightest single panel saddle available on the market, weighing in under a pound. The saddle is designed with the minimalist hunter in mind, focusing on lightweight functionality and breathability. One notable feature is the patent-pending magnetic stick clip system on the side, which allows for convenient transportation of sticks up the tree, as well as a built-in platform holder. The Nano saddle can be folded up to the size of a Nalgene bottle, enabling easy portability. With a four-way stretch material on the back for a comfortable fit, as well as strategically placed padding for hip pinch relief. You can use code EASTMEETSWEST to get free shipping on any Timber Ninja order. If you try it out and don't like it, send it back within 30 days for a full refund. Learn more at TimberNinjaOutdoors.com and sign up for their email newsletter for exclusive discounts and product drops. When it comes to optics, I get the same question over and over again. What are the best all-around binoculars? Well, it's tough to find something that works in every condition great, but after using a pair of Maven B1.2 10x42s, I think I found them. They feature an 8x or a 10x option, superior low light performance, tack sharp edge-to-edge clarity, a generous depth of field, and a silky focus mechanism. All of Maven optics have a lifetime no-fault warranty and hail from the great state of Wyoming. I've been using Maven optics since I bought my first pair in 2017, and I think you should test them out for yourself. Head over to mavenbelt.com and use the code EASTMEETSWEST-GIFT for a free gift with any full price optics order. For all of those that want a truck bed cover for work or play, Diamondback makes the top of the line heavy duty covers that help you do more with your truck. They're perfect for the truck-owning, avid sportsman, outdoor enthusiasts, and weekend project warriors. I'm currently using the HD cover that is capable of holding up to 1,600 pounds on the top. And then I have the Yakima Overhaul HD bars on top so I can put my rooftop tent on it. When I'm not using my rooftop tent and able to use the trifold design of the Diamondback, I have the Crossbin 8 in there to organize all of my stuff in the back of my truck bed. Diamondback is made right here in Phillipsburg, Pennsylvania. If you want to check them out, head over to diamondbackcovers.com. If you've wanted that hunting camp tradition that we talk about, that experience, but you don't have a hunting camp of your own, you're welcome to come stay at my hunting camp up here in the Pennsylvania Wilds called the Elk Crossing Getaway in the PA Wilds. So if you go over to Airbnb, you can check out our three-bedroom, one-and-a-half-bath house that's right in the heart of Pennsylvania elk country. It's only minutes away from a bunch of public land to be able to hunt, hiking trails, outdoor recreation, fishing, all of those things there. The house is completely fully stocked with everything that you need to be able to spend a week hunting deer, taking your family up to see the elk, anything like that. So if you head over to Airbnb and search Elk Crossing Getaway in the PA Wilds, you'll find my listing there and you can rent out my house. Send us a message, an inquiry that you're interested in it and mention that you heard it on the podcast here. Then we'll get you 10% off of your first stay. On this week's Mountain Buck Monday story of the week, we have a story coming from Jameson Grady out of Maine. And if that name sounds familiar, you may remember Jameson from episode 277 of the podcast. I highly recommend you go back and listen to that. It was a super popular one about tracking Bigwood Big Woods bucks in the snow. But here's Jameson's story from another successful year. He wrote in, after guiding other hunters the first 2 weeks at our gun season, it was finally my turn to hunt. My first week of hunting was snow-free, but on November 22nd, they were calling for 8 inches of snow. I woke up to 2 inches of fresh snow, and it was coming down hard. Luckily, I found a fresh track from a logging road just before daylight, and it was a big one. I began tracking him, and it soon became obvious he was searching for does. Despite moving quickly on the track, it was obvious I was losing ground on him, and I began to worry the track would snow in from the storm. I pushed on, and after around 4 miles of pushing through the swamps and thickets, as he searched for does, then he made a 90-degree turn up a ridge, a telltale sign he was about to bed. I crept up the ridge, scanning, hoping to catch him bedded. Once on top, he went into a thick patch of firs, and I knew it would be hard to be quiet, so I poked inside and blew my grunt call. A few seconds later, I thought I heard a grunt back, then definitely a second. He was coming right at me through the firs. I shouldered my rifle to take aim, but my peep sight was full of snow. In a panic, I tried to blow it out, but it was too late as he was 15 yards in closing. He wheeled to run, and I put it on the best I could and fired, dropping him in his tracks. Another tremendous hunt on the track in the Big Woods of Maine. He was a 7 point, 21 and a half inches wide, and dressed 194 pounds, all rutted out with zero fat. Congratulations again, Jameson. That is awesome. We'll have to get you back on the podcast and talk some more, but your skills at tracking bucks is in the Big Woods is second to none, and I give you a lot of credit for that. So congratulations. And if you have a Mountain Buck Monday story you want to share, please send it in via email to bo@eastmeetswesthunt.com. Put in the subject line Mountain Buck Monday, just a short paragraph or two and some photos. We'd love to be able to share them with everybody. So thanks everyone that's been submitting stories up until this point. With all that said, I appreciate everyone listening to the podcast. And if you would, if you like this, you find value in it, please share it with your friends, family, whoever you think would benefit from listening. And if you would, give it a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or just subscribe on YouTube. That stuff helps out so much. And I, as always, really appreciate that support. So with that said, let's jump into this episode with Bo Brooks. All right, we are live. Bo Brooks, welcome to the podcast, man. It's a pleasure to be able to get you to come on.
Man, I'm just tickled to death I get to be on another Bo's podcast.
Yeah, right? it's pretty funny how we met actually too. So both of us are SICK ambassadors, so we were both out in Big Sky, Montana, which you were actually there for the World Elk Calling Championship. Which I sat in the audience. It was the first time I ever watched one of them when you won that here in 2023, which was pretty freaking awesome. And I believe you won it in 2022 also, right?
Yes. Yes, yeah. I did.
Which was so incredible to be able to watch and get to see it. And I'm like, man, that dude's super talented and he's got a cool name. So we had, afterwards I was at the bar just having a drink and you came up and I was like, hey dude, like just introduce myself and whatever. And we got to talking there for quite a while and it was pretty cool. And I'm like, man, it's a pleasure to get to talk to you and someone that obviously pours their heart and soul into what you do. And it shows in the results. So it's pretty awesome.
Yeah, no, man. It was super fun meeting you and getting to become friends with you through this last probably year now. I was getting close to it, and man, I eat up all your stuff you put out too, man. It's killer. And so
yeah, well, I appreciate that. And then what I really like since I've started following you probably for a few years now on social media and everything was like I love the educational aspect that you have, and it's something that I strive to do, whether it's through my own experiences or talking to people like yourself that are you know, do really well in a particular area and trying to help people with it, because like that's how, you know, I've learned a lot. A lot of it's been through just trial and error and experience, but there's so many things, like for example, elk hunting, that without having resources to do it, I don't know if I would be doing it at the level or at the frequency that I am now without having that information. And I think it's so valuable and helpful for people to be able to do that.
Yeah, that, you know, honestly, that's kind of how I'm so close to some of this stuff, like the turkey hunting side. I'm super close to it because I mean, I've got to learn from all these people on the East Coast because I'm originally from the West Coast. It's just a whole different style of hunting that I've never done before. And so, you know, this is kind of like a back and forth. I'm learning the way you grew up hunting, and then you're learning the way I grew up hunting. And so it's kind of, it's pretty cool. It's like, if I can teach people, because I would not be here, I promise you, without the people that taught me and doing the stuff that I'm doing without people teaching me. There's just no possible way. And every single person I've ever hunted with, I learned something. And so.
Yeah, man, I totally agree. And I think that's where it's so, like, I guess what I see, when I see the people that are what I consider the best in whatever their field is, and I get to talk to a lot of them, which is awesome. And I see trends in that. It's like all of them love to learn, and they liked, you know, they don't always just think they're the best at everything, even though they might be, but they want to ask questions and learn from other people and see and have different experiences to continually be learning and applying those things to get better and better and better. And that's, you know, it doesn't matter what the trends are in hunting, or maybe something gets more difficult or you lose access to something, but those people still persevere through it. And that's, I think that's really cool. And definitely something I see as a trend across the board with successful, you know, people.
Those people care about everything. People that are super successful, they care about every little detail, every little thing. And if they don't care about something, it's because they've spent so much time trying to figure it out. I just think that the best thing you can explain it as just pure passion, man, just bleeds through.
Yeah, no, yeah, 100%. And so I guess with that, before we dive into this pretty deep, do you want to give a little bit of a brief background on yourself for the audience, for anybody that doesn't know you, and just a little bit kind of where you grew up and kind of how you got into hunting like you do now?
Yeah, I grew up in a fairly big hunting family. My dad, you know, Casey Brooks, he's a big elk hunter. And if you guys have ever heard of him, and he's just a super accomplished archery hunter. And, honestly, I hunted with him a lot, but I hunted with my mom more. So growing up on the West Coast, my mom and I, you know, elk hunting and, turkey hunting and everything, you know, she was kind of my rock when it came to that. She would drive me there. She would hunt, you know, we'd hunt 20 days a season elk together. And, you know, it's just kind of something that we did together. But, you know, as far as we're probably going to get into turkey, as far as turkey is concerned, I grew up hunting Washington, Oregon, Idaho, you know, California, you know, my younger years. And my dad, he was not a turkey hunter. So, and my mom, no one in my family were turkey hunters. So that was something that we all got to learn to do together. And so, you know, it's kind of cool, you know, starting from ground zero on something like that, you know, just grow up 3 years old with your dad, just like carrying an elk hunting versus getting to do something where he doesn't know what to do. And he's learning constantly. He's becoming just as obsessed as you are. It was a really cool thing. We're big mountain turkey hunters. We're always walking. We hunt them like elk. You know, nowadays I've learned a lot about hunting them back east, you know, so what I've done is I've taken the two methods and I've kind of found my happy medium for that. And so it's really set the mantra in how I hunt turkeys and how I hunt in general.
Yeah. And I think that's super cool as far as like how you grew up hunting and mountain turkeys. And I would think, I don't know. And I'd be interested to hear, like, as far as what some of your Eastern experience has been with turkey hunting, but you know, a lot of the areas that I hunt, where I live in the Appalachian Mountain region in Pennsylvania and hunted through there, I would think that's, you know, kind of similar to out west, other than their Eastern turkeys, as far as the styles and the methods. And like, that's one thing that I've loved so much about turkey hunting here and throughout the East Coast is like, and like in the big woods and the mountain region is just running and gunning and just going and that's why I love elk hunting so much. And I'm, you know, so green still. I've only been elk hunting for 5 years, 6 years, whatever it is. And it's like, that's what I've come to love about it. And I see so many similarities in it, even though, you know, that's not a popular thing for elk hunters to admit, but there are a lot of similarities when it comes to that.
Well, this is how I kind of explain it. And this is how elk hunters, we talk about on the East Coast a woodsman, right? you know, the woodsman. Well, as being an elk hunter, you kind of, that's what you are, is that woodsman style of hunting, but it's, that's just what we do. We're sneaking in, slipping in, knowing the terrain, the whole nine yards. And so, you know, that's a very popular style of turkey hunting, the run and gun woodsman style turkey hunting. That's kind of curated through the, where you live in the Appalachian region. You know, I hunt a lot of the Southern, you know, where it starts in Georgia, and I notice the same trends, you know? And so the crossover there and how we hunt and how we're slipping in and walking deep and just putting in the time and miles and stuff. There's a huge crossover there. Obviously I'm not, you know, calling in 112 elk a season. You know what I mean? Yeah. And so there's obviously some parts of it, but man, I've learned stuff from turkey hunting that I've brought over to elk hunting, and it just goes back and forth for me constantly. And you know, some of the times where I thought I, it's funny is I have more patience sometimes with my elk hunting than I do my turkey hunting, because I'm just going to go find another one. Like elk hunting, I'll sit there for an hour and a half just to get one to bugle. And turkey hunting, I'm like, if he's not gobbling that first 30 minutes or an hour, I'm like, you know, I'm finding another one, you know, even though I probably should put more time in, I probably kill more turkeys that way.
Yeah.
But it's a really, you know, I've actually been wanting to talk about that. I haven't got to really explain it that way after I've really took a hard look, especially with Riven. You know, we launched the elk call brand and the turkey call brand, but they're just so, you know, just so closely related in so many ways, especially how you hunt it. Because what really makes it is different is like hunting them like whitetails, right? So hunting turkeys like whitetails versus hunting turkeys like Appalachian mountain runners is a little bit different, which I mean, you hunt whitetails kind of deep and kind of a little bit different than some people hunt them, but
yeah,
I don't know. It's just so fun to sit back after you have all this time and experience all over the country. You're like, man, just the turkey hunting out here is maybe a better hunter. The elk hunting out there is maybe a better hunter. Truly at the end of the day, it's all brought me up into this person that I'm like, I've got my mind and ADHD. I've just got a million things going through my head every time. You know, I got this bird right below me. I remember when I had a bull doing that one time and I slipped down, got on the right side of the saddle just to pop his bubble, you know, and then I'm like, oh, you know, it's just interesting. So.
Yeah. And man, I think what you said there is so, so important. Like in many places that I've, you know, whether it's been hunting elk or hunting whitetails across the country or turkeys or whatever else, like I find similarities. Not everything translates perfectly, but like you find these things in these situations you get in, like you, just like what you said, you're like, oh, that I've had the situation where a bull is down here below me. And, you know, I went down here and did this or whatever. There's things that you start to pick up on these trends. And, you know, even with hunting elk has helped me become better at hunting whitetails, even though I've grown up doing that my whole life. Of different things I've seen, I'm like, well, why isn't this make sense across the board? And it does in a lot of situations and cases. And, you know, some of my whitetail skills, I feel like has helped me with elk, where maybe I did need to be more patient in certain situations because I've, you know, from patience of sitting in a tree from dark to dark for 7 days, it's like, okay, you start to learn some of these skills that you can apply to different areas. And it may not be like, I don't like to hunt elk as far as just sitting in a tree stand or in a saddle and doing that for 7 days. I literally go out there to not do that because that's what I have to do with whitetails. But there's different pieces of it that can be applied across the board. And, you know, and the same thing that comes with turkeys in my opinion.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's all comes together, but you know, we talk towards that. I'll tell you the one thing, and we're getting off track, but the one thing I've learned though is every single place I've gone still though, there's always one little piece that's different. So like I go and I think I've got all this in my head. Like let's say I'm hunting North Georgia and I hunt Middle Georgia, and the people from there, they're like, our turkeys don't do that. And I'm like, no, come on. But they don't. There's some place, some situations. Yeah. So you just got to take everything, go into it with an open mind at the same time. Be like, I'm going to listen. You know, what we're doing here, we're going to like Pennsylvania, you know, it's like my turkeys in May are just crazy. Maybe yours are still flocked up. You know what I mean? So it's just like super interesting, you know, just, I think the open mind concept and the learning concept. And then what you and I try and do is just broadcast that back because it's so fresh in our mind. We're learning and we're just teaching people what we're learning.
Yeah. And so, it doesn't, the way I always explain it is like, whatever I say does not mean it's right. It's just based off an experience that I've had that's worked mm-hmm. in a certain way. And maybe somebody else can recognize that experience and be able to apply it, you know, across the board. And, you know, although we are talking about elk and we are talking about deer and all these different things, I think it all does apply back to what you brought up at the very beginning, as far as being a woodsman and just learning things as they come with it. And one point you just brought up there is like that I think about, you know, with turkey hunting specifically, is like every year I learn new things, and sometimes it's even in similar areas, but it's different than what I've seen before. Or maybe there's something new that's come in and they've logged an area and the turkeys are using the area differently, or it's grown up since I've hunted it in 5 years and now the woods are more open here. Maybe they're spending some more time there and the hens are nesting in different places. So like you start to learn these things, and it's just being able to recognize it and play off of it in real time and be able to go through that. And I think that's super important. But to kind of go back to your background a little bit with from the calling aspect, you know, I know a little bit about your dad and as far as from an elk hunting perspective, but is he a big, like, on the calling side of things? Is that like his main trick, or is he
when it comes to elk hunting? Yes, yeah. Like, you know, he's harvested, I think, his ninth 400 inch bull, and he shot every one of them calling them in every you know, 80, I think his 83rd bull with the bow. And man, that's how he hunts them. If it's just, we were did that video the other day for Sitka, like, if we're not there calling, we don't want to be there.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? And there's a lot of ways that I've slipped in on bulls, get in the middle of them, you know, especially nowadays. It's changed so much since I was a kid, you know, bulls grabbing their cows and running and stuff like that, that I just didn't deal with growing up. And I've really seen an evolution. But no, dad is an incredible caller and very, very, very good at using his terrain, though, you know, to get in their bubble. And then, you know, he's just reads the animal well. And that's it. You know, he's a big, big mule deer hunter too. So, you know, if you're slipping in on mule deer, you know, 200 inch mule deer with a bow, you gotta be good at it.
Yeah.
I can honestly say I am not 1/10 as good as he is when it comes to any of that. So it's, you know, it's funny. We hunt together now and constantly fight. You know, we're not, I'm preaching this like openness, but I definitely don't have it with my dad. Him and I are so, we have so much fun, but I'm like, no, you idiot. We're doing this. He's like, no. Why would you do that? Then sometimes I'll be right, and you'd be like, "Yeah, that's whatever." Not, he'll be right, and he'll be right, and I'm like, "Yeah, that's trash." And so, you know,
yeah, just, was a one off. Yeah,
yeah. He actually never let me call, like, turkey calling up until, I mean, like, until I was like 20 something. He wouldn't, when we hunted together, he wouldn't let me even call, and I'm like, my dad, he's like, "You can't make that sound right." He's, I'm making all these different noises. I'm like, "Dad, I'm telling you, I hunted by myself. I got him to go." Like, it works. And he's like, "No, man, stick to the yelp, just stick to the basics. It'll kill turkeys that way." Okay. Well, then, you know, then I started hunting by myself a lot. And through the years, and I'm like, okay, I'm calling now. Now he's just like, now it's if he picks up his call, I look at him, I'm like, "What are you doing?" And he's like, "Okay."
That's so funny.
We have a lot of fun.
Yeah, that's cool. So like with that, is that where you kind of got that, like, want of having that interaction with the animal, and like how you've, you know, become, you know, being just proficient at calling every type of animal, it seems like, that's out there, and finding a huge passion in that and having that. So explain a little bit about why you like to do that so much.
Well, you know, it's really funny. I've always been drawn to it. All my dad's making always lots of weird noises when I was growing up, but you know, for me, like, man, I've just been like everything. It's not just like the, you know, the birds, that everything. I want to just be there and I want to understand it. And I had turkeys, pet turkeys growing up, just so I could understand them and hear them. And, you know, I've just like always been so drawn to it. Like, I can't even explain like right now, just like the fire that gets me fired up, just thinking about just getting out in the woods and just being it, you know, the sounds that I'm trying to make and never having to, I know it sounds weird, but ever stumble in that situation. Everything I put out, I want it to sound perfect. And I want it to have emotion. I want you to feel it and be like, you know, yeah. And the calling contest side, I've always been super competitive. I started waterfowl call competitions at the age of 9. And so I started doing that. I didn't do a turkey calling or elk calling competition until I was 17 or 18. So, I mean, I was just doing waterfowl calling competitions. We didn't have any around us.
Yeah.
And so, you know, all of it though, in my mind, I'm like, I want to be the best at everything. I don't want to just be good at one thing. I want to understand it all, like almost to the point of where I'm like, it's too much that I, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That passion we were talking about earlier, like to the point of bleeding the passion.
Well, and you know, it's funny you say that because like, for me, I've realized that I am not good at everything. So I can't be, and maybe that's a bad mindset. So I've really like focused pretty heavily in certain lanes, and like whitetail has been like my main thing I've been trying to learn the elk hunting side. That's something else. And turkey hunting, something I've done. My grandpa used to make calls, and he's in Earl Mickle's book of World Callers of America. And like, it was still in his late 70s, turkey hunts, and is really good at it. And like, I've learned a ton from him. My dad loves the turkey hunt and everything. And I've always done it, but I've never put a ton of effort into it because I've always just been like, I can't be good at all these things. But honestly, I think that mindset had kind of, I don't know, I'm trying to get a little bit away from it and get back into like really becoming a student of the game with turkeys and being that way, because I haven't been like, I haven't improved my calling in forever. And it's like, the way I've had success with turkeys, and I've killed a turkey almost every year, except for the last, you know, in Pennsylvania specifically, in the last few years, I've been traveling out of state and doing some other things in the spring or just struggling. And I'm like, you know what? I need to get better. I can't just be having these mediocre results. And really, I think too, is like, I've always explained it as the way I've turkey hunted is I just do it by persistence. And eventually I find a bird dumb enough that wants to die. And but I've never learned like the real, like, okay, these are the types of calls I should make here and there. But one thing I have that I feel like that I do well is reading emotion in any animal, yeah, and being able to kind of pick up on that emotion and make sounds that evoke that emotion back in them or get them fired up or be able to do it. It's just like, I need to learn the skills to what you just said of like making those perfect calls or knowing when to do that and being able to get those ones that I struggle with to become better at it.
Well, I think that my turkey hunting style is very similar to yours though, in a maybe a little different way, but man, I am searching for the bird that wants to play my game. I don't like messing with the turkeys that don't play my game. If I want to shoot one like that, and it's the only one I've got, I will. I'll just get in there as early as I possibly can, get right underneath this roost tree and get him to fly down into my lap. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's that, and or get in his way. But if I'm, it's all it is just time. You would be super successful at it if you just had time. Timing on the calling side is so much more important than any sound that you can make, in my opinion. Understanding when to say it, what to say, like you're saying, reading the bird is so much more important than hitting a cluck per here. And it's a grab bag full of tools. If you don't know how to use a hammer, then there's no reason to have it in your tool bag. You know what I mean? And so it's all comes from trial and error. You're going to hit your hand a few times, but you know, that one time that you miss and hit it right on the head, now you've learned. So it's just like you pull out a screwdriver, a cluck purr, and then he just, and he's there at 100 yards that maybe you've heard off the internet, like, hey, just cluck and purr and scratch leaves instead of calling at him the whole time. Understanding that timing and finding those little successes, even if you don't shoot the bird, and you're eliciting a response, and or he's getting closer, he's searching for you, and he comes behind you. It's just time. That's all it really is. And it's the same thing with the practicing on the call. It's time. Like, it's not fair.
Have you ever wanted to have Levi Morgan, Andy May, Johnny Stewart, and others available at all times? Well, you can with Cyber Scout from Spartan Forge. Cyber Scout is like the ChatGPT for outdoors men and women. You can ask it any questions related to bow building, scouting, hunting, survival, and a whole lot more. I think you'll be impressed with how it responds. Cyber Scout is currently out now for a select group of early beta testers and will be available to the rest of you really soon. The entire app is a complete tool for planning your hunt with incredible aerial imagery mapping, journaling, deer prediction, and some of the most accurate and detailed weather data. Use the code EASTMEETSWEST to save 20%. And if you're still on the fence, give the 14-day free trial a chance at SpartanForge.ai. CVA has been America's number one selling muzzleloader brand for over a decade. Hunting with a muzzleloader opens up a ton of hunting opportunities across the U.S., and I've been using the Acura series. But they don't only make badass muzzleloaders. Their line of centerfire rifles are great quality and not terrible on the wallet. The Cascade Short Barrel is ideal for tight quarters, deer drives, and quick shots in the big woods. You can check out their line of muzzleloaders, rifles, and accessories for every season and every range at bpioutdoors.com/CVA. If you use the code EASTMEETSWEST10, you'll get 10% off of all CVA products, which includes rifles, muzzleloaders, and accessories.
You know, for what people, they see all this great calling that I do now, but that they don't see is the 7 to 8 hours a day that I would practice every single day sitting. Like the turkey calling, I'd be sitting right next to a real hen or five of them that I had as pets. And I'm sitting there listening to them going, and that made my hen in my head. You know what I mean? So I've got different hens that I've heard through my life, and I could tell you right where I've heard it. And that's just, it's all learning, and it's all like, just, it's so much information. You know what I mean? It's just like, but what do I do at this point? It's just like you with a whitetail. Like, what do I do? You got a buck that's got a doe bedded up and it's 32 degrees. I could tell you four different things that I would try and do.
Well, you know, yeah, I mean, it's kind of like the same scenario with like whitetails. And one of the biggest questions I get asked all the time is like when you're scouting in season and you're going, and I always talk about when you find that hot sign and you need to stop, when you just get that feeling, that gut feeling, like I shouldn't go any further because he's probably bedded somewhere close. I don't want to bump him.
And it's a like, turkey thing too, man.
When people are like, well, what? When do you know when to stop? And I'm like, well, for me, it was just, I've screwed it up so many times that I've learned that, like, now all of a sudden, like, I literally get like a gut feeling, like I start seeing things like, okay, there's a bunch of rubs here. This scrape is all tore up. I can smell it. Like, just stop. Yeah. Don't move any further. I take another step. It might be, you know, a bad situation. Maybe I back off and climb a tree here. I sit on the ground or do whatever. And that's, and, you know, kind of what you're saying there, a lot of it has to do with the time of spending around them and being able to pick up on it.
Well, I know the best turkey hunters that I know out there have patience. The ones that are very, very successful, and they're very successful everywhere, have patience. I have patience, but I don't have as much patience as them. So there's a lot to be said for that. Harold Knight will sit on a ridge and just scratch leaves for half a day. But in a realistic mindset, not everybody has that type of time, right? What my game plan is I do increments, man. And like what you're saying, it's just with a bull. I mean, I hit that wind and I go, okay. I'm like, sit down. I just sit down and I just start calling and I wait. And then I might get him to bugle or hear him raking. And then I might make a move or I might wait. You know, it's just the same thing with a turkey. I stop and I call from great looking setup. Okay. Call, 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 call. Wait, he doesn't come in. Okay. I'm going to give them a little bit longer, and then I make my next move, which isn't huge. Usually it's usually another move up to another tree. I'm like, I got to get into his bedroom and make him do something. And that's just my style. There's other people that would just sit there and just scratch leaves, and he would gobble at that. And eventually he may walk by, you know, that's just, it's a style thing. I like my style because it's a lot, for me, it's a lot more fun. And if I mess it up, I'll go find another one.
Dude, there's something to be said about finding what you like to do and just learning to be good at it, like, or to have in have success with it. You know, I've talked to Zach Fehrenbaugh from the Hunting Public many times about whitetail hunting. He doesn't like hunting in a tree. He likes to hunt on the ground and do that.
Yeah, he's a
like,
stud.
I know he's great at what he does. And he's like, and you know, he attributes it to of like, I love doing that. And that's like what I have fun doing. So I've learned ways to make it work for me. And kind of like what you're saying, where, you know, there's guys like, for example, my grandpa, who's one of the patience guys that'll sit there all day scratching leaves, just making some super soft calls. Like you can barely hear him, just quiet, just, and he'll just be patient and wait him out. Even if that bird doesn't gobble for an hour, like he just is patient with it. And he may kill that bird a few hours later sitting in that same spot versus, you know, being the aggressive thing. But in my opinion, it's like, finding what you like to do and figuring out how to do it well enough to have the success that you're looking for.
I'm going to steal that. I like that. That's awesome. hit the nail on the head, man. We don't go out there not to have fun. I do not have fun sitting there for a half to three quarters of a day scratching leaves. And, you know, honestly, where I grew up, if you did that, you'd never kill a turkey. Because our turkeys are just so ADHD. They're just like, I remember we always used to have these guys come out from actually PA and some of these places. And I'd sit there and I'd walk in and I'd see this guy sitting by a tree. And I'm like, oh, sorry, man. And I'd walk in and I knew the guys and I'd be walking out and he's still sitting there. And we met at the truck later that day. And I'm like, what are you doing? And this is before I went out west. This is when I was dieting. Out east. And this is before I was guiding there. And he's like, I was guiding on public land. And he's like, man, he's like, no, we just sit here and we call every 30 minutes. And I'm like, dude, like, I appreciate that's so cool. But dude, you'll never kill it. Those turkeys are so ADHD and like, they're gone. If they're not gobbling those Miriams and Rios, they're gone. They're just like, bye. Unless they're like a super heavily pressured, like May 20th bird. Yeah. That's really smart, you know, that only gobbles every five times you call. Then I just treat him like an Eastern again. But man, it's just so interesting. We go back and forth with all this all day, but man.
Yeah, no. So one thing I'm kind of curious of just kind of breaking down, say a morning for you of, and I guess we'll put it in the context of Eastern birds from the standpoint of like, okay, you go in the morning. Are you typically trying to roost a bird the night before, or are you going in kind of blind to some areas that kind of explain like the very beginning stages in the morning when you wake up and you're heading out to a spot?
Oh man. When I'm hunting like in the South, man, and I'd never get a bird roosted the night before because they just don't gobble very good. Like if I do, I'm probably going to kill them. You know what I mean? I said, it's just really hard. Like I'm just now getting to the point too, where I'm not traveling near as much and I'm kind of able to scout here. And so, I mean, I'm probably going to be a lot more successful now that I can scout. Like if you have time and you're planning on shooting two turkeys in a state, like if you spend your time in March and early April, like figure out where the birds are, where their roost is. So you have A, B, C, D, and you know where they're going to fly up and where they're going to fly down. I mean, it's just like getting on them. But all the places I go, a lot of times it's the first time I've ever been there or I haven't been there for a year. And so like I'm slipping in and I'm listening right off the bat. I usually try to get to, especially since it's the mountain stuff I'm hunting, I try to get to a high point and I just listen. I want them to gobble on their own, you know, if I can. And so I wait for that. And if I can get them to gobble like that, I slip down and I try to not let them know that I'm there, but you know how that goes. Not every morning, especially on public land, that they're going to gobble on their own. And so, especially pinpointing them. So, you know, I heard a really interesting piece of knowledge, you know, I think it was one of these guys I know was hunting with Chris Parrish and they had three birds gobbling and they're sitting there and they're like, okay, which one are we going to go after? And they heard there's this one that's just hammering every single time anything makes a noise. He's got one. It's over here on the side that's gobbling. He's gobbled like two or three times. You know, we're going to go kill that turkey. And they're like, then he was like, what, why is that? Is that turkey's not going to get messed with. And it hasn't been getting messed with because it's not hammering its head off and just get in there and play the game with that bird. And yeah. So it's really interesting to think, you know, it's always like my mornings are get out there, find the bird that's going to play the game. I try to make my play on it. I'm not super aggressive till about 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock. Because like they always fly down. They always shut up. It seems like for a few minutes and they're messing around with their hens and whatnot. I'm just letting them do their thing. You know, if I am not able to get close enough to the roost,
yeah.
You know what I mean? And that's a lot of times, especially open early season, man, you ain't going to get anywhere near that roost without them seeing it. You ain't going to get within 300 yards of them on the ground if you don't have a ridge between you and them.
Yeah.
You know?
No, I mean, that makes a whole lot of sense. And like, it's funny you just said that story about Chris, and it reminds me last year opening day, I went to the spot and I knew that the one side of this creek system gets heavily hunted. And it was opening day. I'm like, it's going to get, what do you know? Three birds go off on three different points. And I'm like, man, and two of them were just freaking hammering, just going nuts. I'm like, I'm not even going to go after him because I'm going to be sitting here. There's going to be a guy over here in this tree. Well,
yeah.
Both of them either got shot or got shot at within like an hour of, you know, morning people were there and set up or whatever. And then the other bird, I ended up relocating later in the morning and never ended up killing the bird, but it was just, it's just funny just relating back to that story about, you know, the ones that's hammering there, especially in a high pressure type area, it's like probably going to have somebody else chasing in after them at that point.
You know, I've also done days where I just walk right past them. You know, those gate birds, they're really enticing. They're right at the gate, right off the road. But man, if I can get in and just keep walking past them, and that's where most people are going to stop every day. They're going to stop on that bird. He's probably been called out a bunch. And so what I do is I'll just keep going if I can. You know, it's for me, you know, 2 miles isn't much for me. Like I'm like 2 miles, I'll just snap my finger. I'm in, you know, and a lot of times, you know, compared to where I grew up, like for turkeys, man, I, at home, there's people that walk, I mean, you start getting into birds at 4 miles behind these gates and people would do it every day, but down like Georgia and whatnot, I get into 2 miles and I'm past that 2 mile mark. I'm not seeing many boot tracks. And so, you know, the threshold to getting into birds that aren't getting touched can be, is the bar isn't necessarily too super high, which I really like. That's like, I feel like Superman. I'm like, I'm 2 miles in, man. There isn't boot tracks in here. The birds are gobbling and, you know, I'm going to keep going. And so it's kind of interesting. And what I'm usually doing, like, especially like this coming up early season, like I'm trying to get behind the private. So I dive in, like try to get as far as I can in on these mountains. And I dive off the top to get on the edge of the private to call them off of it. Because those are usually the highest concentration of birds, or the birds have moved up the mountain. You know what I mean? But those are, there's a lot of times those birds may not get messed with. You know what I mean? Where at home, a lot of times everyone hunts them on the private, and I'll call them off the private sometimes. But if I can find one that's deep in the public, that means he may not have hens because he's moved up so high on the mountain. It's just the Easterns are a little bit different. I kind of treat them a little bit different. I've had very good success with time and effort and just patience, just calling them off the private, because eventually they roost on the public all the time. They want to be on the public a lot of times.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like elk. I mean, elk, I'm like, why are the elk on the public? Why are you here? Like there's a 50,000 acre ranch below you. And I used to guide on that big ranch and I'd always find them on the fence line. Yeah. I'm like, get off the fence line. Like, come on. It's just interesting. You know, like in the heart of it, there's like two bulls and then the whole rest of the herd lives right on that fence line because they just loved all the forage and the, you know, all that stuff that you can find there.
Yeah, that is so true. It reminds me of Montana. The one spot I was hunting was just like that for elk. It was like, it was, you know, they'd spend their nights and stuff in the private and they'd come bed right up on the line of the public and the private. And it was super frustrating at the same time because it was like right in that line. I didn't want to hunt close to it and have, you know, a bull. You'd shoot it and run into there. But it was like you kind of had to play that game because that's the way that they were living. And with turkeys, you know, like what I've seen especially like in Pennsylvania, is like that they'll, you know, roost up on the hills and kind of fly down and go down. If there's fields or something that are on that private down low, and spend some time in there, and then, you know, mid morning kind of come back up in and work up
the
through
party the birds
there. Yeah, the party birds.
Yeah, those are birds we like to mess with, man. I like that 9-10 o'clock. You're walking through the woods and you accidentally trip on some leaves and you're like, sit down right against that tree and get ready. You know what I mean? It's just most of my success, 10 to 2. And then again, people won't. It's kind of funny that it's something I found very successful, though, because these states that you can hunt in the afternoon is that I want to say it's like 4:30, like right when, you know, you can feel the 10 degree temperature drop. And so it's when that sun starts to go down a little bit, you feel the temperature change, and then boom, they start up again. And a lot of times they're by themselves. And you got about an hour right there. I've called in on those really high pressure birds. Some of my best success been right there at the very end. And I don't even know if I'm by the roost half the time. I'm just trolling still. But it just, for whatever reason, when I feel that temperature change, I'll just sit down. I'll try and find somewhere where I can hear, and I start calling. I'm like, there's got to be a tom in here. And all of a sudden I either hear or he just cow, cow, and comes running in, and I shoot him. I mean, it's so interesting. And that's why Missouri, man, I hate that state. I love it, but I hate it. You go to Missouri and you got to stop at 1 o'clock. And I'm like, oh, every day at 1 o'clock, those birds start gobbling like right there at that time. It's just the birds in the morning, like, a lot of times I don't even want to hunt the roost. That's my least favorite time to hunt a turkey, is right off the limb.
Well, so, you know, that's, and so Pennsylvania is one of the states that you'll hate, because we close at noon for the first couple of weeks of the season. And then the end of the season, they open it up to all day being able to do it. But I may be wrong, but I think when I was a kid that you couldn't, it was always just noon, and that was like the stopping point. So I never really hunted much in the afternoons or evenings, never really thought of it. And even to this day, like, I've went out a little bit, but it was more to scout for the next morning versus actually putting time into it. But I've heard you say this, and a couple of other buddies that I have that have had success doing that kind of towards that evening time frame there, and had success with it. I'm like, maybe I should put a little bit more weight on that than I have in the past.
If you know where they're roosting to, it's a really good opportunity. Like, having the time and you're figuring them out, like you know your birds. I can just tell on your face right now, you know your birds good. it's like, man, like, if you can, you just get in there and just, it's so interesting. There's like so many days you get your teeth kicked in, but then you could have like 3 days in a row where you're getting into birds every night. Like, I was in Louisiana, and the birds in Louisiana, there are more people, more turkey hunters, I bet you double, than there are turkeys in that state. That's a rough state to hunt turkeys in. It's like Arkansas. And I mean, it was fun. We got in there in the morning. I had one bird gobbling really good. Didn't quite get on it. And honestly, I didn't kill a bird while I was there, but that, I only had a day, as I was going down to a wedding. And I went that afternoon, and I slipped into the area I was at in the morning, and I had 7 toms gobbling their heads off. Like, cow, 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 cow. No, it's just like, it's right at that time too. I got in there, sat down, started calling, didn't hear anything for a little bit. And as soon as they started rolling though, it's like, pow, pow, pow. I could feel that temperature change. And it's something about it, man. That afternoon time, they just usually don't have hens, and they're searching. Even if you don't hear them in the beginning, they're searching, they're looking, and they could remember you from that morning too. You know what I mean? And
yeah,
it's just, there's a lot that goes into it. They're smart animals.
So I want to kind of go back a little bit to, all right, so back to like in the morning time frame, when you're talking about, like, all right, you don't typically like to hunt them right off the limb unless you know, okay, you know one's roosted here and you can slip in somewhat close enough. What is your goal, like, if there is foliage and everything, to be able, you want to get as close as humanly possible, or do you have like kind of a buffer zone that your ideal situation would look like to get to?
It just depends on the situation, the time of year. Yeah. And don't get me wrong, I hunt the roost every morning. I don't, but I don't, I could, I'm also filming all the time too. So like if I was just killing turkeys, it'd be different. If I was just killing turkeys and I could get as close as I humanly could, I would, like within 100 yards, you know, if I can handle it and get right in his bedroom and scratch and try and get him to pitch my way, I'm going to probably kill him. You know what I mean?
And that's the other thing. Like when you do get in there, are you just trying to scratch leaves? Are you trying to do any calls? Are you trying to deploy a decoy, or like, what are you trying to do?
If I can get a decoy out, I will. If it's dark enough and I know he's in the tree, like early season, I can see him in the dark and I just slippery, just put that decoy out, the strutter or the Jake or whatever. I mean, you know, I love hunting with a decoy. I love hunting without a decoy. You know, there's all that crazy stigma about it, but man, I go either way on it. And so, you know, it's like you go and you get set up. If I can stab the decoy, he can see it. He's going to pitch my way. You know what I mean? A lot of times. And he's going to come beat that decoy up. If I get in there and I don't have a decoy, a lot of times I can get closer too, though. Is it's not going to make any noise. So I can crawl right up there and I could get right on the edge and try and get him to pitch my way. It's super situational. And I mean, what's more important, like if I've hunted a bird 2 days in a row, is trying to get to the direction he's going to go.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so if you get in his way, you'll be very successful.
Yeah. That's one thing that I feel like I've definitely struggled with is knowing, you know, have an idea which way they're going to go of like, all right, where when they fly down. Now it does help typically if I'm like, okay, there's private and there's a field somewhere or whatever, like, okay, they're probably going to head that direction. That's in my head, that's what they're going to do. But if I get to like just endless timber, it becomes a little bit more difficult for me. I typically try to get like either just above them. Like I find them kind of like deer on points a lot of times, or on the side hills around points. They'll have some hemlock trees or something they might be in, or some big trees around there. And I'll either try to get up on the top there or kind of on the level on like a side hill logging trail or something where they're going to work back and then just, you know, set up and kind of wait. And I've always done, you know, some soft calls and everything but I never know like, okay, what call should I be making? As far as what level of the audio level should I be making it? And that's something that I definitely struggle with a little bit. The Mobile Hunters Expo is a consumer-based hunting show unlike any other. It provides an interactive learning experience where you can try all things mobile hunting and learn from the best in the business. Come experience an unbiased, community-based environment where you can improve your hunting skills and find the right equipment for your needs. I'll be speaking at the Nor'easter Show in Mannheim, Pennsylvania at Spooky Nook Sports from August 9th to 11th, 2024. So come check it out or either of the other shows in Michigan and Georgia. You can purchase tickets online at themobilehuntersexpo.com or grab tickets at the door. I'll see you there.
I usually, and the first thing in the morning, always air on less than what I'd want to do. You know, I there's a lot of times where they start going, and I want to just get right in her face. So I'm just going to go, and just like real nice and pretty. When I'm successful, I still some days I'm like, oh, I'm getting in her face. And it's like 50-50. They fly my way or the other way. But you bring up a really good point. Above them or the same height. Like, I hate being below a turkey. Like, every time I've ever been below a turkey, I've shot a few of them that way, but they always get up on the hill above you and they strut back and forth on that ridge. And you just sit there and watch him because he can sit up there. He can see. He feels good up there. Like, if I can get above him, and I had Mark Drury with me one time, and this turkey was, oh, it was 1, 2, 3 canyons down from us, like, way down there. And I started calling and he's coming. I'm like, okay, we got to get up the hill more. Mark's like, no, we got to be right here. And I'm like, this turkey, I'm telling you, there's a road above us. He's going to go straight up and hit that road. And it's just like, it's there. It's, and that's just the thing. It's where you are, right? If I was with Mark, Mark's birds probably would have walked right across there. It came up, but it's just my turkeys. I know they're going to, the ones that I grew up hunting, you know, that bird's not scared to walk up. He's going to go above me so he could see everything. He was gobbling behind us, and I'm like filming, and they're in front of me, and I'm like, yeah, that sucks. And so, you know, it's just, yeah, it's just, that's just, and if you have a decoy, you can kind of get away with it more, you know, but just, I always try to get above them. Usually, like, I want to be where there's a ridge between me and them or something in between me and them, so they have to stick their head over the top.
Yeah. Dude, oh, man. That's one thing that I think my dad has taught me and my grandpa, like, the most, like, ever since I was a kid, of, like, having your setups to the point where you get to a point, if there's a terrain feature that they have to, when they poke their head, they're dead. They're dead at that point. And that's always been kind of one of the things that I always keep in my mind when I'm hunting and doing things. And it is nice a little bit, like even in the earlier season when there's not as much foliage on, having terrain can help a lot with getting away with a little more, getting closer in situations.
Or even just killing a turkey, because without terrain, man, in the wide open woods, that those birds can see like 300, 400, 500 yards. I couldn't tell you how many times I'm sitting up against a tree perfectly still like this, and he's coming. He'll come for 300, 400 yards, but then it gets to like 100 and goes, and I'm like, and so it's just really just interesting how that all plays out.
Yeah. And okay. So like another example is like, all right, you're talking about like a lot of times, like 9 o'clock in the morning through, you know, mid morning, you kind of go on there. And are you like, or say you heard a turkey in the morning, he flew down, he got with some hens, he's kind of roosted up. Or not roosted up, penned up, but like what is your kind of play at that point? Like what do you think is in your head as far as what do you want to do or what should, or I know everything's situational, but even if you want to tell a story that can.
So you think he's got hens is what you're saying?
He's got hens.
So he's got hens. What I usually try to do when he's got hens, I either try to get in his face and get the hens to come towards me, which I'll do something like, let me see. Yeah, let's get this thing pulled apart. I thought I had it pulled apart. All I'll do is I'll hit them with some cutting, and I'll get in there, and I'll go. Just, and then she'll, a lot of times, if she comes back with a, then I'll cut her off again and I'll slowly back it off as they're coming. I'll go back to her. Just kind of trying to keep pulling in that rope. Mark's really funny. Mark Drury and I were buddies, and he's like, Bo, you throw, what I do is I throw the heavy line out first and then pull it in and soften it up. What he does is he throws the soft in and it starts getting faster and faster as it goes. And so both ways work. But for me, I really like to get her mad and then slowly back it off so she has to come look for me.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it works really well for me. Probably the best case scenario is if you know they're going a direction. Like say they're in a river bank, like a river bank. They, a lot of times they'll get down on those little creek beds or river banks. They'll be walking it up, get down, try and get in front of them. Or they're on, you know, they're going to move up this ridge. They've been gobbling on the top of this ridge every day. Just get up there. And just soft calls, scratch it. Just don't mess them up. Don't steer the hens a different way. Just let them come to you.
Yeah. Yeah.
It makes the move.
Yeah. No, that makes a whole lot of sense. And this kind of, I you know, back to the reading kind of the emotion of, you know, what the hens are doing. Cause I'm from basically what you're saying at that point, you're more so, probably not, and maybe I'm wrong, but you're not going to call that gobbler off of those hens. He's already kind of got them there. You're trying to get the hens to come to you at that point and him to follow.
Yeah, especially early because they're not going to leave them. If it's a little bit later, I'm willing to wait them out. You know, I will wait for those hens to leave him. I know that eventually what I've done before too is I've just left them too. I'm like, okay, you want to just hang out with those hens all day? I'm going to come back at about 2 o'clock. And I'll see you then, you know, or noon or something, and sit down and start calling. You know, there's just a lot of scenarios. But if I'm going to stick with them all day, I'm going to either try and get in front of them. If the hens get back at me, I'm going to make her mad and I'm going to pull her up. Or I'm just going to wait him out and just let him play his game for a while. And eventually, Eastern's all it's going to be in their mind. If he's gobbling or whatnot, if when he's not gobbling actually means more sometimes. He's just sitting there and he's thinking about it. It's gnawing at his mind. He's like, she's up there on the ridge. She's not talking to me. I can hear her scratching. I need to go see what's going on, but I got you down here. Like, and then she leaves, like what I've seen it so many times that Tom's strutting like this and he kind of goes down and pecks at something. And he looks up and they all just bolt and there's, they all leave him. And then he's like this, he starts looking around and he's just cow, 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 just yelling. And then all you've got to do at that point is just like literally just anything. And he's just up to you.
Yeah. Do you feel like, do you use mouth calls exclusively or do you use other calls as well?
No, man. No, I think that it's foolish to just use a mouth call. You know what I mean? There's the box calls sound so good nowadays and the slate calls. And I'm telling you, there's every Tom has a hen in his mind that's going to set him off. Sometimes it's good and sometimes it's bad, right? So you've heard so many times you're sitting there calling this bird just go, go, go. He's coming up the ridge. You're like, oh, he's done. He's going to pop. Then you hear, and you're like, oh no. And he gobbles 10 times harder at that hen than you and just runs right to her.
Yeah.
And so it's like, I couldn't tell you how many different times I'm working this bird and I'm sitting there. And it's a lot of times there's a property line below me. There's a private and I'm on the public. And I'm calling it this bird and he's gobbling every 3-4 times. And I'm like, I'm throwing down some good stuff. I'm like, this is some of the prettiest mouth calling I've done in forever. You're not even gobbling. And I pull out this dang box call and I'm like, and it's, double gobble. I'm like, what? And I'm like, I'm going back to my mouth call. And I call again, doesn't answer. And then I'm like, I'm like, oh, here he comes. Or my buddy has this terrible box call. And it's not terrible. It's like, it sounds like this. It goes, it's like the, and it's like, I call it the pterodactyl. And I remember I was calling these birds, there's three toms on this other side of this fence, and I'm calling at them, and I'm just hitting them. They're, but they wouldn't move at all. And he starts calling the pterodactyl, and then all of a sudden I see him running up the hill. And I'm like, and he shot one. And he's like, I told you had to bring that. I'm like, trash, man. It's just interesting. It's a different octave. It's a louder octave, right? And so, like, if you're I run my box call all the time when that bird's not right in front of me because I'm not trying to ruin my mouth calls either. Running them at full capacity is just destroying your mouth call. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And my rule of thumb is if I can get them to answer a box call, I can usually kill them.
Yeah. Yeah. So my last two birds that I've killed were box calls, and it was just, like, it was really funny on how, like, the one was a Miriam's. Well, I didn't kill that one. My brother did. It was funny. We were bear hunting and ran into a podcast listener that was like, he had just killed a turkey. He's like, hey dude, there's like a bunch of turkeys, like 4 miles back in here. If you guys want to go in, like I'm done hunting there. We went back in and my brother he was a Montana resident at the time, had a turkey tag and, had all he had to think was a box call. And I was like, well, I'll call for you. And we went back and called that bird in and it ended up killing it. And then same thing in PA, where it's like, I hear it so many times, like, oh, everyone has a box call that doesn't work in Pennsylvania. There's so many turkey hunters, man. I still find a lot of times that you can get a bird that goes off of it. And I like kind of what you're saying. It sounds like what you're saying a lot of times is just kind of figuring out what that bird likes.
Might
have to, listening. Okay. He's responding to that hen. Like you said, like, okay, maybe I want to sound more like that with this specific bird, but that bird over there is completely different and may need something else. So having that toolbox and learning to be proficient with those different tools is helps you out.
Oh, it's 100%, man. It's just having that there. It's just like, whitetail hunting, you know, it's like, so you're like, you talk to a guy. I remember there's this guy that hunted, it was my friends at Habitat Flats, and they're like, they had a deer hunter that was in, this old guy, and he's like, I'm going to go, he couldn't get up a tree stand or anything, I'm going to go, and I'm going to rattle on the ground. They're like, well, I've had lots of people hunt in the area, and, you know, you're not going to call, whatever, you just go sit. Shot a 193-inch buck, just sitting on the ground, rattling. It's like, there's so many times that I've been told something won't work in an area because there's so much pressure, dude, you're hitting them on that day, right?
Yeah.
If it's their day, and I don't care if it's a bull elk, I don't care if it's a mule deer on the rut, I don't care if it's a, I don't care what it is. If you hit them on their right day, they're going to act right and they're going to do what they need to do. And it could be the right day to hear a box call. It could be the right day to hear a mouth call. It's just trying all those different things. And then if you're not successful, trying the next day, something a little bit different, you know, a different approach. And so I've hunted some of the highest public, the hardest hunted public land in the country for turkeys. And I run a box call. I run a mouth call. I run a slate call. I crow call at them. I do everything that I normally would do. And sometimes I'll back off and I won't do something because I'm not liking it. And I learn from it. But man, just writing something off because you don't believe in it, you know, I think it's very foolish in a way.
Yeah. Oh, I know, dude. I think about that with me with whitetails and how I've been with rattling. So like even like in Pennsylvania, a lot of people will tell me, oh, you can't call at all. And I've grunted in most of the deer and have different grunt bleat sequences that I use. And like, yep. I love the vocalization of whitetails too. And that's like a big part. My dad's the same way with the strategy of hunting whitetails, but rattling is something that's, you know, quote unquote, never worked for us. So it was something that I don't even carry anymore. And I'm like, but I've talked to people through the podcast that have hunted different states and different areas. And I'm like, well, maybe I just wasn't sounding realistic enough. Maybe I wasn't trying, you know, and I said I was going to do it last year and I actually completely forgot about it, but I need to start bringing them again and just trying it and trying different strategies with it and seeing if it would work. Because maybe I'll unlock something with a specific deer that I wouldn't have been able to do otherwise. And it's like, it doesn't hurt to be able to try it.
I totally agree. And I mean, it's just like one of those things, well, if everybody says it doesn't work, that means no one's doing it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's just like, it's so interesting. Right here by the house, there's some public land that's called Land Between the Lakes. And I went out there and I called in a turkey this last year. And they're like, you can't call at them except for scratching leaves and clucking and purring. And I got this bird to gobble and I went in there, back, 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 back. And he's like, this came running right in. And I'm like, okay. I will say one thing. That way of calling, though, is tried and true, and it works, and it's just like sometimes if it's not working for you, it's just like a gobble on a mouth call. I don't gobble very often at turkeys, but it's like this last year I called in four that otherwise I wouldn't have even got to, and I called them across property lines that I normally wouldn't have got to go, and I just started, kow, kow. It's always my last, is I'm like, you know what, I'm going to try it.
Yeah.
Sounds good. I feel good. I'm just going to try it. And then all of a sudden he just gobbles right in front of us. And we're like, whoo, get down. And it's every little thing. It's a grab bag. Even just the slipping, you know, you're slipping in on a bird and you're like, may only work 50% of the time. But when he does come in, it's like bowed up, you know, ready to rock.
Well, so, yeah, you know, it's funny. I was just, before we got on this podcast, when I was, this morning I was driving down to the gym and I had one of your mouth calls that you'd given me, one of your Bo Brooks edition power calls. And I was just messing with it. And I'd do that in the truck when I'm driving to places. And I was like, one thing I've never tried to do was gobble. And I was just trying to do it. And it was pretty comical. The result, I definitely sounded like a Jake. If anything, but, it was pretty interesting, but how do you gobble on a mouth call? Maybe that's not as easy explained here, but.
Let me see. Let's find one. I got a bunch of mouth calls here. So what I do is instead of like, this is what everybody wants to know though. So what I do is I'll take this call and I'll use the middle part of my tongue, like the middle front part of my tongue instead of the tip of your tongue. That's why you'll sound like a Jake. If you use the tip of your tongue, you'll sound like this.
Yep.
Your middle part of your tongue. And so I go, tucka, 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 tucka. And then you walk before you run. Tucka, tucka, tucka. That slow. And let's practice that before you try and put it all together. Everybody always wants to put it together right off the bat. That's not good for business, man. I'm telling you, it'll be good to learn. And it's kind of just become like a show off thing when I'm calling and whatnot. Yeah. It sounds good, but I mean, it's become fairly Easterns out of all the subspecies I've ever hunted react the best to a gobble call. Out of every turkey I've ever hunted, like if you hear gobbling back and forth, they always seem to, like, if they're on the ground, they always at some point come back together. And what I've noticed is, like, I get out there and I start gobbling at them, and I've really had some good success with it, especially when it's in big woods where it can rattle a little bit.
Yeah. Oh, that's really cool. And you know, the walk before you run type of deal. I mean, that's like with anything you're learning, but every, you know, including myself, I want to get to the end, you know, you're like, I want to see how I can do it. And so, you know, I'm just sitting there trying to make it happen versus going through the slow roll. It's like with archery, it's like, you don't just start out shooting at 60, 70 yards.
No.
You got to start out with learning how to execute a shot and doing that. And then you have a sight on
and then you shoot
20 yards and then, you know, you work your way out sort of deal. And yeah, that 100% makes sense. And the last thing I want to ask about the specifics with like calling is, how much do you put weight on, like, do you feel like the specific noises or sounds that turkey make, like, do you try to understand what they're trying to say, or do you, I guess, how do you think about that? Are you like, oh, they're doing this, like, this is probably what they want to hear, or this is a conversational piece that they have, or how do you think about that?
Usually I'm painting a picture. So I'm trying to prove to that Tom that I'm not a hunter. If that makes sense. And so, like, everything I'm adding in, I'm trying to paint this picture of, like, when I'm clucking and purring and adding whines in, I want no doubt in his mind that that's a hen right there. So I'm trying to paint the picture. It's me and another hen just, you know? And so he's like, okay. I see what you're doing there. Okay. And if I listen and I hear a hen, I'm like, yeah, she's mad. I'm going to yell right back at her and make her mad. So she comes in and checks me out. And when I'm calling to a Tom, it's like, say it's middle of the day. And I mean, I try a few different things, you know, to see what he's answering. You know, it could be just a, and he answers, and then I'll give him a second, Mike K. If he answers that, I'm like, oh yeah, okay, he's eating up everything I'm throwing at him. And if he doesn't, I'll go back to that hen. So it's like, I am understanding what they're saying and being very important that you know what they're saying. You know, you hear the clucks and purrs and the scratching and stuff. You know that he's just over there screwing around, or you hear him spitting and drumming and whatnot. I mean, it's just all of it adds to, like, the
real
graphics in your mind and the realism. You're like, okay. He's going, if you can keep convincing him that you're real, you know, adding, like, there's some things that you'll add in there. It's so funny. Like, I'll have my buddy, like, he adds a sound in that, like, they don't necessarily like, because they don't, it'll kind of shut them down. You know what I mean? But if you're just, like, very concise with what you're saying, you're just, okay, I'm going to try this. Yuck, yuck, yuck. And I'm going to add a little bit of scratching in leaves. Okay, he doesn't like that. Back it off. Go back to this. You know what I mean? And so it's just, and if he's not answering the cutting and yelping, kill it. Just sit back. Curiosity kills the cat. Let him think about it for 30 minutes. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, that, and with your style of moving and being more aggressive, do you put like a time limit on yourself as far as like when you would make that next move? If like,
it doesn't what I do is, like, I'll do it in between calls. I'll be like, okay, I'm like, I want a call, but I need to wait a little bit longer. Okay. I've got my phone here. I've got it set for 10 minutes. Just wait and let him do something. Don't call. Like, especially on the smart birds, that's what I'll do is I'll have my timer on my phone. I'll sit down and look at it. And I'm like, gosh, this is killing me. I want to talk to him, but I'm not going to. Just let him do his thing, or maybe it's 30 minutes, or maybe it's 5 minutes. You know what I mean? And just like, just letting him chew on it some. That's a big deal. And then I'm like, okay, I've been here for 30 minutes. He hasn't moved a muscle. I've given him 20 minutes of silence and he's still in the same spot. I'm going to make him do something.
Yeah. Now that makes sense. And I like the idea with the phone, because that like forces you to stay through it. Yeah. Cause otherwise you can convince yourself like so much time has passed or you go through it. But like, I'm the same way where that works well with me. I do it. It's so funny to say this, but like, if I'm hunting all day during the rut, I do it with blind grunting. And I also do it when I'm going to eat snacks. It's like, okay, if I can make it an hour to this point, then I'll eat my next snack. Otherwise I'll eat everything early in the morning and then I'm struggling in the afternoon. So it's like, I put these like timestamps. And for me, the way my brain works, like that helps structure me in a way to be, I guess, diligent with it.
I have to do it, man. My favorite is when they're really interacting with me and we've got a good back and forth and I can do whatever I want. But when you get on really smart birds, you got to put time limit on yourself and you got to really be concise with what you're saying. It's just like, and it's frustrating, but when you shoot a bird after doing something like that, it's always that much more rewarding.
Yeah. Okay. Now transition a little bit is I want to hear a little bit about kind of what gear you're taking into the woods. Like when you're leaving I know this is also going to depend on the area as far as like from a clothing aspect and like, you know, whether you're using a vest or a tool belt, which is funny because there's the Sitka film that just came out, Minimalist in Mind, which is really good, by the way. I recommend anybody go check that out on Sitka's YouTube channel. But kind of like, all right, what are some things you're going to, let's start just to make it simple for you from a clothing aspect. What do you start out with? What's in your mind when you're kind of building your system to go out turkey hunting?
Man, early season, I wear my elk hunt and my mountain pants stuff early. You know what I mean? Because a lot of times it's not warm. It's usually really cold, you know? I'm trying to remember. It's a mid-weight hoodie, isn't it? Yeah, I think it is.
Like a merino, or you mean or is it synthetic?
No, synthetic. Because I think the merino's new. I like that. The guard stuff is obviously, I have it on underneath it, but man, it's like, I just really like a heavier stuff early season because I don't like being cold when I'm turkey hunting.
Yeah.
And then I can shed into guard. And so like, it's really like, I've never dealt with bugs like I do here in the South now. And so like having the guard is so important, like for me, but like when I'm hunting out West, it's always the mountain pants. And then I wear my guard and then I wear my jacket over the top, something a little heavier because it could be snowing that day.
Yeah.
And so, and even in Michigan and Pennsylvania, you never know, man. And
yeah.
So it's like, it just depends. And then choosing between the tool belt and the vest, it's like, we talked about this. I'm like, the way I hunt, I don't want to say for fun, but like for filming versus it's like different. So when I'm filming, when I'm hunting for fun and we're not running a camera, dude, every day of the week, I'm going to run the tool belt. Just because I don't want anything with me and I don't have to have a GoPro on my shoulder. I don't have to have batteries in my backpack and like I can walk farther. I can go deeper. Like I don't carry water with me just because like I think it jinxes me. Like even when I'm elk hunting, like I'll dive into a canyon. And I'm like, I'm not going to carry water because if I carry water, I'm not going to kill a bull. Like every time I was guiding, like I wouldn't carry water with the clients and we'd be super successful. And then I bring water with us. I'm like, gosh, dude, we got all the way in here. We're like chilling, eating snacks, drinking water. Like we're not hunting hard enough. Let's keep at it. And so like, it's super interesting. And then like, but the vest is I've never been a vest guy, but the vest is like 10 out of 10. Like it's the best vest I've ever used in my entire life. Like it had changed my life. Like I'm down to wear this vest. I love this vest. And so like, when I'm filming and stuff, I can fit everything in it. And when I'm not filming, even before the tool belt, I was so happy because I'm not freaking burning up. I don't have something hitting my butt all the time.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's just a 10 out of 10, man. It's just to change the way I view vests at least.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, man, I'm just, I mean, you know, the guard stuff, man, it's changed my life too, though, because I'm not freaking permethrin out like I have to, you know what I mean? It actually works. Like, I don't think we talk about that enough at Sika, how well that guard system actually works.
No, dude. Like, I when it first came out, I did a podcast with Chris Derrick and Dr. Carl Miller about it, because like, so I have Lyme disease. I got it from a tick. We have ticks all over the place. Like most of the country does now.
No way.
Yeah. And like, it's so, and you know, when it really became big as far as being a lot of ticks around here, like I remember being a kid and my dad be like, we'd tuck our old Army BDU pants into our socks, like when you go out, and being able, now with the Equinox Guard, they got the internal gaiter that you tuck into your socks. And so I'm a huge proponent of the guard system, from the pants to the top. And then I'll still spray like my boots and my socks down with Sawyer permethrin and like still do the whole thing, but it adds so much to be able to tuck everything in and have like basically no exposed skin. But even when it is hot, and say like a lot of mornings we'll have here in Pennsylvania, it might be 35 degrees in the morning, but it might get up
to
be something during the day, you know, by the time you're around that noon time frame and you're hot. So I like to be able to slim down, and I run hot as it is for the most part. So like for me, I wear the Equinox Guard stuff, and then I have the Mountain Evo jacket I like, because it sheds water, it's a wind cutter, and then the Ambient jacket, which still breathes well, so you can move
it. The Ambient is what I wear too when it gets cold. It's not too heavy.
Yeah, and it packs down, so you can, like, even if you're just wearing the tool belt, like, you can tuck it in and strap it onto the bottom, and it doesn't take up a whole lot of space. Or if you have the vest, you can shove it down in there. I want things that are, like, minimalist on the clothing standpoint, but still going to keep me warm, because that is one thing that, you know, you hear about it, and I've heard other people talk about turkey systems and clothing, you know, before, you know, even Sika got into it a lot, and it was always, like, lightweight, it's hot. And I'm like, a lot of times in Pennsylvania, at least, it's cold some mornings, you know, there's frosty mornings and stuff that you're out there. And it's like, you got to be kind of looking at it from a layering system like you would for elk. And the Mountain Pants one that I freaking love too. That's just like an all around awesome pant. And earlier in the season, I'll wear that a lot and just have that sprayed down with permethrin to
worrying about it as bad either early as the tick stuff. At least for me. But I will say, I got one tick all last year, which, I mean, that was, and I don't spray down my boots. I probably should, but I was getting like 12 a day, like when I was out turkey hunting in Kentucky and Georgia and whatnot, I wasn't getting them at all. And so like I've had, you know, I didn't pay attention to it as much as I did last year. I was like, oh man, like this is really, this is really working for me. I mean, like I truly, I wasn't hearing the story either. Up until like this year, people talking about all the crazy stuff, which, you know, I've been told about it since I was a kid, but I grew up where there was no ticks, zero, never even had a tick where I was growing up. And so like, and then I go out in my yard and I would get six when I first moved down here. I'm like, get off me. What is this? And I actually ran into seed ticks one time. Trash, dude.
Ooh.
Dude, that took, I had to take a bleach bath, and I was wearing shorts that day. Dude, never, ever again, ever. Dude, that was the worst thing ever.
I've never run into seed ticks yet, but when I was in West Virginia, my buddy Josh Elderton had gotten them really bad and showed me like how his whole entire side of his body was just like bit up and just tore, like. And I was like, man, I want nothing to do with that stuff, like with those at all. And he's like, you hit a nest of them and you're just at that point.
I just whole body, man. I didn't know what was going on. I'm like, we're driving back from this like archery shoot, and I had like socks that were pretty tall or something. And I was just kind of a weirdo then. I still am. But I'm like sitting there. I'm like, dude, I am itching so bad. Like, I don't get poison oak either or any of that stuff. So I'm like, what is going on? And I moved my sock and my whole leg would just cover black, like with just ticks all the way up my leg, up my body. And I'm like, this is the first time I ever went outside when I came here. I went to a little archery shoot. I'm like, okay, it's in the summertime. I'm like, okay, I'm going to go do something. Like, just do something when I moved here to work. And I'm like, I didn't go out for another year. Do anything. So I'm like, this is not going to happen for me. And it was too hot too. I'd never felt humidity either. And I'm like, that was trash, man. It was so hot.
Dude, that is insane. And I don't think, you know, we talk about that enough, or anybody does, as far as like the tick side of it. And I remember I did like an educational video on Instagram, a reel or something a few years back, and talking about the guard system, and then also how I'm spraying things down and the frequency of it with Sawyer stuff, and like looking at it, and someone's like, I don't want those chemicals in my body. I'm like, well, I can tell you right now, from someone that had Lyme disease that ended up turning into having all these other problems with food allergies and having all this joint pain and everything, I will take, you know, even though that it is, you're not spraying it directly on your skin, and even the stuff that's in the, you know, Sika has it done already from the beginning. Like, I can promise you, whatever problems that you may have, which aren't even proven to be able to have from it, are way less than having a lifetime of dealing with Lyme disease and having to go through that. And I just, me personally, that's how I view it. And I think it's super critical from that standpoint. And I just, I'm always cautious of it and being aware.
Now I'm even more of a believer. Golly, man, now I'm going to go home and spray my stuff down. I just didn't grow up around any of this stuff. I'm still learning. It's crazy.
Well, and the water thing is crazy to me, because I carry a lot of water, and that was always like my one thing on why, like, when I first got the sample of the turkey tool belt there, I was like, man, I don't know if I can carry enough water with it. But I ended up, what I did was using either the bottle system from Sawyer that has like the water filter, where I could just go to a stream and fill it up and dip through the straw on it, or I'll take the cap off it, which actually fits on my Nalgene bottles. It holds a little more water. I can put that and do that, so I'm covered. Or I'll use a bladder if I'm using the vest. But man, I'm a water guy. Like, I need my water. That's just me.
Well, I've really gotten to where I like water too. I'll be honest though, man. This is something from the film. We were doing the film, and dude, I didn't even know what a Nalgene water bottle was. These are like, hey, do you have a Nalgene that we could put? I'm like, what is a Nalgene? What are you talking about?
Really?
I had no idea.
Well, time.
I had no clue. And they're like, what? And then I went to like Dick's Sporting Goods looking for one for the shoot. Because I'm be honest, like, I carry, like, just if I do carry water, I just grab one of the water bottles and I just rock it. Yeah. and dude, it's like, but that being said, this is not safe, kids. What I do is not safe. Like, not going in, like, I'll dive in like 3-4 miles, and I'm, by the time I'm getting out, I'm like, but I'm like, oh man, I got into them good. It's because of my stigma with water. If I carry it, I'm not, it's like, I feel like the world is going to reward me for like going through the pain of not having water.
You're kind of like an old timer, and I shouldn't say old timer, because then my dad's gonna say I'm calling him old. But like, my dad's generation and older, I feel like they just didn't need water. Like, they never carried water when we were hunting or doing anything. We're out all day, and I'm like, I don't know. I just feel like maybe I'm a little softer, but I need a lot of water.
Man, my dad never would bring water, and my dad never brings food either. And so like, even duck hunting. Like, so every, you know, duck hunting is like just eating snacks all day.
Yeah.
I just never, dude, it's just wild. As I started being around people who are like cooking in the blind and all sorts of stuff, I'm like, dude, what is this? you guys give me some more of those Pop-Tarts. Now I always just have like in my truck, I just have like a bunch of random, like terrible 40 snacks, like get some Skittles and I'll live all day off it.
That's hilarious.
Yeah. Peak physical fitness here.
the one other thing one of the questions we answered, a bunch of them that people had submitted in, but one of them was, if you're carrying like if you're carrying a slate call, is there any preferred like type of call with it when it comes to slate that you like the sound better than another?
It just depends, man. So out of all three of the calls, my least favorite slate, like, I just don't like the sound as much, but it's a kind of a necessary evil I carry with me.
Yeah.
We make a few of them at Power Calls. I think they sound amazing. I've used really high end ones that people build. The only thing is, man, they always get wet. And then I'm like, I'm sitting there and I can't even make a noise on them. You know what I mean? That's the hardest part. I'm a big slate guy, big crystal guy. And really, like, I don't know if we're going to be able to see this, but holding it like a crown, I don't know, this instead of, it'll make it sound more like, instead of like when you, a lot of people hold it like this, you know, it's getting really, it loses that pop. And so you can get a lot better. Whereas it's got those holes on the bottom that are meant for breathing. Let them breathe so they can, so you can get the full range of sound. The only time I close it off and put it flat on my hands when I'm clucking and purring, like.
Yeah.
Makes it real pretty. So.
Yeah. No, dude, that's awesome. And it's yeah, pretty cool to kind of hear your system. And I like the idea of like, or not that it really matters my opinion with it, but that you have different calls. And it's like, even though you're, you know, known for your mouth calls, but like, and how you run them, but just like being open-minded and seeing like, okay, there's multiple ways to skin the cat here. And like, think and reading the bird and being able to do it. And like, one of the biggest takeaways for me from this conversation is really reading the scenario and being a, you know, a true woodsman of like learning the birds that you're hunting. Cause you can't, like, I don't care who you are. Everything that anybody says that have had success in a certain way is based off of their experience, and it doesn't always perfectly apply. So if you were to say, oh, the only call that I use is this bat wing call, and that's what I'm using, and this is it. And it's like, okay, maybe that works for this scenario, but you know, a turkey here may not like that, or this situation.
It's like five ridges over. He can't hear you.
Yeah.
This is what I preface to everyone I tell. I was a bad caller at one point in time. I've not always been good at turkey calling. I mean, I grew up not very, like, I just ran a box call. Didn't even run a mouth call for the first 3 years I hunted turkeys. You know what I mean? I've killed turkeys. I had to, up until I was about 19 years old, I was not the, at that next level turkey calling that I am now. I've always had to maneuver. I've always had to slip. I've always had to try 10 different calls to get one to go. Just what really the mouth calling is really just become a cheat code is all it's really done for me. And that's it. And out of all the calling that I've ever done between waterfowl, between elk, between, I immediately see the results from turkey calling from good mouth calling. So like those birds that I hit with a box call or my mouth calling before I could do a two note yelp would take me an hour. Now it's taking me 5 to 10 minutes.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? They just come right in. And the same areas, they act the same every year. And then I started mouth calling it next level, like a next level type of calling and adding everything in. It's like, okay, what, this isn't working. That's not working. Okay, boom. Okay, I've got you. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so there's still plenty of birds that give me the runaround, but it's just interesting, you know, to see the immediate reaction. So.
Yeah, no, 100%, man. And it's definitely inspired me to get better with it and learn some more. And I think like for me personally is like from taking out of this, it's like I need to really get good at learning the basics of the different types of calls. And then, so then when that situation applies, I'm not handicapped by my own abilities to be able to make that sound or try it to see if he's going to respond to it.
Yeah, exactly. It's exactly right. And it's like, what happens when you're at that point where you've let out all your rope, right? I've got 500 feet of rope where if you just run a box call that yelps this loud, you've got 20 feet of rope to pull them in. So you're going to run out of that rope really quick. But if I have a long rope, like box call, slight call, you know, cutting, slipping, get around and pop that bubble. You know what I mean? There's so many different things I can pull. And sometimes I pull too fast and I fall on my face, but there's other times that it keeps me up and I just get him right at my feet.
Yeah, no, dude. Yeah. 100%. And I've one thing also that why I want to get better with mouth calls is the less movement too.
It's a big deal.
It is a big deal. And it is running, you know, calls and being able to do that where, you know, everything, you know, you have your face mask pulled up or anything, and you might have your kind of hand up there, but you have a glove, or maybe you don't even need to, depending on the situation, but it's just less movement than having to move with the box call or the slate, or me, I leave everything. If you go to trees, I sit by turkey hunting, you'll probably find a slate call here. You might find this here. I lose stuff all the time, leaving them in places, Or I'm like trying to reach for it when a turkey's coming in and I can't remember where it's lost in the leaves somewhere that I threw it down. It's just,
Well, that's it. You know, with the turkeys coming in, a lot of people, you know, they don't call at them. And I kind of just put this together just now. Man, a lot of people don't call at them because they're running a box call when they're coming. I'm pretty bad. Like I get a bird, like he's at 70 yards and he's kind of going to my left. And I'll just go, and he'll just, it's, I want to hear him. And he's that close. I want the whole meal deal. I didn't come this far to not hear him gobble. So, you know, and a lot of times I got a camera in my lap. So I'm like sitting there and I'm like, and
yeah,
I'm like, okay, cool. That was cool. That was cool on video. Just keep them coming. Yeah. So
that's freaking awesome, dude. So if people wanted to learn more, cause you do a lot of really good actual tutorials on calling and stuff and for all of your content, where can people kind of go and find some of that?
The most of the stuff that I've got compiled is on TikTok. So just Bo Brooks turkey calling on TikTok or out calling. You'll find plenty of stuff. And I've got tabs in there. It's like tutorials and we go through all of it. And honestly, I actually am pretty good about answering too. Like I try to answer every single message I get on Instagram and people send me videos on their calling and I try and help them out. If it takes me a few days, it's just because I'm hunting usually, but we try our best to just to answer everything we can. And there's a lot of calling scenarios. I mean, there's just a guide to turkey hunting. So it's on from our perspective, obviously there's a lot of ways to skin a cat.
Yeah, no, it's awesome. And I've followed along on TikTok and then also on Instagram and then seeing some of the stuff you did, I think it was called Top 5 Calls, just a short piece for Sika. Those videos have helped me out a ton and you're really good at, just dumbing things down to be able to understand them in a way that something that might be, you know, somewhat complicated to people like myself and being able to explain it in an easy to digest way. And I value that. So I definitely recommend everybody go check that out and check out your content and then also your calls. So explain kind of the call companies, you know, Power Calls, and then is Riven separate on the elk side?
Yes. Power Calls, I was brought in 7 years ago for Power Calls to design these calls. It was a waterfowl company and work at Higdon and whatnot. I did the decoys, turkey decoys here, but no, I've got a line underneath it. All the calls are my design. Power Calls, so www.power-calls.com. We hand make them all here in Western Kentucky. They've really become a hit through the years now. Yeah. It's really fun from going from maybe selling 100 a year or what I had my Brooks Custom Calls back in the day, selling them out of my backpack to where we're at now, you know, and then the Riven side, I started it this summer, the elk call company. It's we got the wood bugle tube and all that stuff. It's pretty next level. And I'll tell you, I've taken a lot. I think the best call builders in the world are turkey call builders, the people that understand the layering, the latex, the quality, everything. And I've taken what I've learned there and I brought it into the elk side, something that we haven't done before. So
awesome. Well, awesome. I hope everyone goes and checks that stuff out and I'll be running the calls this year and playing around with it. So super pumped about it.
Yeah, man. Well, I appreciate you having me on. This has been an absolute pleasure.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks for taking the time out of your day and appreciate it, Bo.
Okay, I'm going to ship some more calls out.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of East Meets West Hunt with your host, Bo Martonic. For more great content and to stay up to date, visit eastmeetswesthunt.com, Facebook at East Meets West Outdoors, and Instagram at East Meets West Hunt. If you enjoyed today's episode, please review and subscribe, and we'll catch you next time.